So wait, are we starting or are we
yeah,
not?
Start. I don't know.
Sure?
Who he is. Yeah.
Are you sure?
I mean, I'm not positive, but I think we're going to start.
Okay. Welcome to the Art Last Podcast. It's an arts and culture podcast with me, Sophie Chalk, and
Seema Rao.
There she is. She clocked in. If you would like to support, actually, no, I lied. And who else do we have here?
Oh, yes. We have a producer.
Hello, I'm Savita Rama. I am supporting Sophie and Seema with production.
Yeah, our superstar. So Savita has joined us and we are infinitely grateful because we are two people who cannot stay on task ever or on time. Oh, Joe brought caffeine. Okay, we can officially properly get started. But Seema was kind enough to mute herself. So today, this is maybe something that's like a little bit new for us because we've been a little bit lazy and trying to, I don't know. We just think that there's an assumed understanding with our listeners and that you know who we are and that you've been following us. But because we keep saying, please send this to a friend, there are maybe some people who don't know who we are. And maybe we thought after one and a half seasons. that we should introduce who we are and what we do and like why we're here, I guess. I don't know. Take it away, mate.
That's a deep one. I would say, so I'm curious, when did you know you wanted to be an artist?
When I realized I had no other skill sets. No, that's a lie. I did an office management job when I was like 17, 18. Fucking hated it. Made my eyeballs bleed. Just realized that like most environments like that were not environments where I felt safe or respected. I also, like all my friends were in art school. I had an aptitude for photography from a very, very early age. Like I was always picking up cameras when I was like 7 years old and artsy people in my family were like, oh shit, you should maybe get your kid a camera. Like it was never really a conscious choice, I guess. It was just something that was always going to be where I ended up. Because I have a lot of stuff I want to express that can only kind of happen through, and stuff I need to regulate through that can kind of only happen through creativity.
So. I do feel like so many people that we talk to artists or we talk about artists,
yeah,
have this like positive feedback loop in their life. Like they were good at it and they kept doing it. Because like yeah. I would say for me, I was somebody who, when I was a kid, I was very good at drawing, like sort of naturally rendering. I should say like good meaning like I could
you
render.
You could like put on paper what you see.
Yeah. And very like without training, I could do that. And so when I was little, I took classes in an art museum where I ended up working years later. And but I always knew I wanted to be in the arts and I always knew I loved museums. Though I would also say that I grew up, my parents worked on a museum campus. Like, so I grew up like going to the museum all the time. So it was open to me. Like it was something that I understood.
Yeah. I think it's funny because for me, like I come from doctors and lawyers and like my family are all very much siloed in that particular industry, but my parents always had like a real appreciation of art and culture, I guess. But like my
I would say this the opposite. My parents never went to the museum. I went with my godmother. They loved music. I grew up with my dad. Same. Went to like every like the Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, my mom too.
Orchestra. We have a great orchestra. And then music. But I think visual arts was not something my parents had any idea about.
My mum always made sure to have like really beautiful First Peoples art around. Like my mum's cool shit. She was like arrested in the 70s for protesting for land back in Australia. Like she's been all over it for a long time. You can kind of understand like why my sister and I are the way we are. Like it's just kind of always been a part of how we navigate space, I guess. But for me, like, I never enjoyed anything apart from being in art class. And like, I guess this is also one of the reasons why my family doesn't value what I do in the same way, not only because they're doctors and lawyers, but because like, I didn't pursue this in like the kind of rigorous traditional way. Like it's something that I fell into, I guess, and just never left. pixies.
I do think
here.
That the rigor, I think the rigor of the arts is something that nobody,
they don't
that a lot of people don't understand. No. I think that the rigor, so I think that the problem we have in society is we see rigor in very simple terms. So yeah. Like you work really hard in math, you are good at school. You know, when really like drawing has a kind of rigor, photography, learning a skill has
being
a rigor.
Being an artist requires a lot of problem solving. You have to yeah. be like, you have to be able to communicate like a philosopher, like an academic, like a student, like a teacher. You have to be able to market yourself and be a business. You have to make money off of what you do. You have to be able to talk about what you do. You have to be able to like get people to understand things the way you do. You have to be everything. You have to be
you
like
to be
a marketer, a communicator,
but,
a maker.
But even
like
just the
everything.
Production takes so much problem everything. Solving yes. and so much problem solving that you're doing without thinking. Like I think about when I never wanted to be a studio artist. I don't necessarily have that much to say through my art. I was very good at rendering. I thought about being a medical illustrator, but yeah, because I think I'm verbal. I think that's it. Like, yeah. I'm high verbal. Like, everyone has something to say. It's just how they say it, right? Yeah. So through my visuals, I didn't. But I am able to do it, and I've taught
after
it.
This weekend. Fuck.
I certainly know how to say lots with my words.
Oh,
and
yeah. That's what we love about you. That's why I was like, oh, bestie needs a platform.
But, like, think about the problem solving. Like, I was thinking, But I've taught studio. I've done a lot of studio. I have that capability. But I am absolutely not, like, nobody would ever accuse me of being an edition artist. Like, I'm just not that rigorous, let's say. And so I think a lot about when you're cutting a plate, let's say. And I have to admit, like, when I cut a plate, I often just free cut it. I'm not like I watch these like really amazing printmakers who are like transferring a design and doing stuff. I'm just like, because I can, you know, like I can do it well enough and I'm not auditioning it. So like I'll cut it. But then like you cut it and then like sometimes you're talking to somebody, go a little too deep or you go
Yeah, it happens.
And then you have to fix that. And you do that whole thing without even realizing it. The amount of problem solving in art production that happens in an instantaneous way is pretty amazing. You know, and I don't think people realize, like, you know, this Yahoo who kept menacing me the other day on TikTok, he was like, well, what did you do? Basket weaving? And I was like, you know what?
The disrespect in this house.
Exactly. But like, during-
You're gonna say that to Indigenous women to their face? Fuck that- you.
They don't even know Indigenous women exist. During COVID, one of the many things that I forced my children to do was try basket weaving because, like, I had the supplies from an old workshop
right.
that I did in my house. Uh-huh. And I gotta say, like, on my deathbed, when they're thinking about pulling that plug, it could be because of the basket weaving. It was so hard. It was so freaking hard. And for me as a studio person, I have taken lots of classes, like ink, on silk and like paper making. I've had to take a billion, like, you know, glass blowing. I have never had a studio class that's hard for me. Like, I've never walked in and been like, oh my God, I gotta figure out how to do a wheel. Because I've done so much, right? It's always been easy for me.
Yeah.
And we two people in the arts could not get a basket. Like, we were like, this basket's gonna bring drivers a drink. And like, we got it. And that basket, wherever we go in life, will be with me because we made it. But I think the people, because this goes back to how they do not understand the rigor of the arts.
Yes.
They don't understand these skills and this problem solving and how hard it is. And it's because we perceive it to be easy.
You make art for a living.
Yeah, it's like fun and pretty. We've devalued the arts so much that they can't perceive it. And so like, I would die for any of these people who claim basket weaving. I'd like to see you weave a basket, buddy. Like, dude, like, you're not, I didn't make that mark. I don't know how that came up, but I'd like to see that happen.
No, really, really. And I guess this is like how we always end up talking about abstraction, right? And how people are like, it's not that difficult. And it's like,
my kid could do it.
It is.
My kid could do it. Your kid could not do it. And what's sad is that you can't tell. Like, I think it's also what you can perceive. It's actually your fault. You can't tell.
No, no. That's because people are, they don't bother to learn. But I had a question for you.
Yeah.
How did you know that you kind of wanted to be in the arts? Because, like, you can enjoy it and you can grow up around it, but what, why did you make it a career?
Lord knows. Lord knows. I really enjoyed,
I had a crush on someone that I worked with.
Oh, that'd be great. No, I didn't. But
you didn't follow Joe around? He followed you around. I know what happened. I'm like, actually, now I say it. No, I know what happened.
I would say that throughout my like elementary, middle, and high school, because I was basically like on public transportation to a major art museum, I spent a lot of time there and wrote a lot of essays. And I always loved talking about art in these essays. Like in fourth grade, I did a slide presentation. That's how old I am.
Aren't they called decks now the corporate world? I find that so weird.
Decks. They found sense of fancy when they say deck. But I did a slideshow about Van Gogh I don't want to say her full name because you know how some kids you grew up with, you always said their full name?
Yes.
Right? Because her name was Sarah, so we had to use all
You had like 15 Sarahs? No, yeah, I get it.
She's an awesome person, law professor. Mm-hmm. Really nice, still nice, still awesome. But we did a presentation, fourth grade, upstairs in Mrs. class. I guess I just said her last name.
Yeah.
Nobody go menace.
Do you want me to cut that out, mate?
Yeah, maybe don't. Maybe cut that. yeah, cut that out, poor thing. I think she's probably still with us, too.
Oh,
I
don't think it's going to be such a mess to edit. Oh, my God.
You could give it.
Fine.
I think we're fine. I don't think people are going to go menace poor her. No. It's not an easy name to say. Yeah, that's a good
bleep
idea.
I've never done a bleep. That'll be funny.
Poor lady. She was a great teacher.
Yeah. Actually, she was a great teacher.
We read, and this is what, like, I would say the moment that I was like, I want to work in an art museum. In fourth grade, we read The Mixed-Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankenweiler, which is a story. It's a like a very classic American children's book, and it's about a pair of children who hide at the Met.
Oh.
And they sleep over. And actually, I'm old enough that I read it just as the Met was getting rid of this fountain that people threw coins in. And so I remember that our head of school was at the Met. Mm-hmm. Back when I was a little kid, a lot of people would go to the city a lot. I'm not like that close to New York, but I didn't grow up that close to New York, but people would work there. Like they'd spend, dads would work there, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think maybe it's probably still true, but like dads would have to travel to New York a lot. Some moms did too. But like, so somebody was going there and it was like they were closing down the fountain, I guess. And I have to say, like, this is in my memory, so maybe I'm like a decade off. I don't know that, but I remember that. And I will not make you bleep the next person, but so and so, that Mrs. So and so went to take a picture of it. And these kids slipped over the museum, and I just remember being really like, that was just so exciting to me. Like, and it's funny because like growing up with one of them, and you know, there's like people who live in cities that have this, right? Like you could be at the Nelson Atkins, you could be at LACMA, though that place is a wreck with construction. You could be from Buffalo. Buffalo has a great museum.
Yeah.
You could be from a lot of American cities and not realize, like you could be Chicago. The Chicago's really a tourist museum too, so you really do realize it there. Mm. But I think like, there are a number of American cities, secondary cities. Omaha, the Joslyn, though that's also under construction. Atlanta, the High. You know, that there's these, all of these, the Amon Carter, the Dallas Museum of Art, the Houston Museum of Art. Houston MFA. I was like, I know that sounds wrong. Houston MFA. But these are cities that are just living cities, right? And their museums aren't really like tourist attractions. Certainly, people will travel to see certain exhibitions there.
Yeah.
But they're just regular old cities with regular old stuff, and you go on your class field trip, and I think we as Americans don't realize, like, I remember when I was working at, and I'm purposely not saying the museum I used to work at, but it was a museum that had three Van Goghs on view, and I had just installed them, and my aunt, I think I've told this story before, but my aunt had come in from India and was so shocked she almost touched one, and I was like, you can't touch it, I work here. And my aunt said my aunt said to me, there's not there's not one Van Gogh in India. Now, this was in, would have been in like 2000, like in the early 2000s. So it was like, so I don't know, maybe like some rich guy's gotten one now. I don't know. Somebody'd have to like Google that to see if there's still a, if there's no Van Gogh in India. But in like, you know, the very early 2000s, she said that there was not one that she could see. Wow. And I think that like, it really struck me then how many Americans have no idea of the things that are sitting in their towns.
Oh my God, that you're in proximity to. I think that was one of the most bizarre things about moving to New York and like walking down the street and just seeing in some random little gallery, just like a Keith Haring. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like I'm I'm in it. Like it's everywhere around me now.
Yeah, I mean, even like tertiary cities will have like a Van Gogh. I mean, like Rembrandt print colleges. Yep. Like, you know, we did an episode recently about the
Harlem
Renaissance.
Have so much fucking art.
Oh my God, like so Oberlin. So we did a show about the Harlem Renaissance. Some of the loans were from Fisk, which is in Tennessee. Go walk in that university museum, dude. Like, damn. You know, like. There are, Kent State University in Ohio has one of the largest textile collections in the world. Like, we have so many amazing assets in each of our towns that people don't know. And I think for me, like, so then basically, like, I really loved it all the way through. And then in college, I did like I was a docent. And then.
What's a docent for anyone who doesn't know?
It's an unpaid educator. I am very. Anti-docent, not the human beings themselves.
A fancy word for unpaid educator.
That's right. I am not against the humans. I am against the idea that we have unpaid labor doing the most important work museums do, I have to say. Because museums are education spaces. Anyway, so then I went to graduate school and got a museum job and worked my way up. And then I worked at a couple different museums and I consulted for museums. And I've had like every education job. As I said, I worked with all kinds of collections, like Van Gogh's, Botticelli's.
You've done the rounds.
I've done the rounds. Non-Western art. Tamil sculptures, Chinese bronzes.
You've earned the authority you speak with, and I think that's why we love you, you know?
Thanks. So so I worked in very traditional parts of museums. I worked in education, interpretation. I did digital interpretation. I just did a lot of museum stuff.
Yeah.
But then what happened was I decided that museums do not pay a living wage.
Funny that, isn't it?
So then I left museums in 2022, and now I work as a UX designer, which is a lot happier.
Yeah, you do well in corporate.
I don't know why I even went to the. I don't know. I'd rather have. I wish I had been. Like, I would have probably. I would have been. You know, I'm thankful. I would say this.
You would have gone bust your way to the top to CEO.
I would have, dude. I would have. I do not want to be a CEO, dude. I am so thankful for my CEO.
Because you would come home just as frustrated.
Oh,
my God. And Joe would be like, I swear to God, didn't you leave museums for this reason?
I'm so thankful for my CEO. He doesn't listen to this podcast, he knows it exists. But he is one of those people, he's so smart, but he often says, like, he went to, with his wife to, he would be horrified that, so I'm definitely not saying his name. But he went to Florence and he was like asking everyone, like, what do you think? And then he looked at me and he was like, I won't understand anything you think. And I was like,
at least
and
he's
I
honest.
Felt badly.
At least he's honest.
And I felt badly. Because, like, I always, anybody who goes to Florence, I'm always like, don't forget to go to the baptistry. The mural, the mosaics are amazing. Wait, Tuscan banded.
Anyone with half a brain would listen and take your advice.
No. You know what I actually think, but what it made me think about is, and I think this a lot, and this is actually why I do the TikToks. I It really breaks my heart how much for my whole career in museums, I had no idea what people were like. It breaks my heart to think how much I could have done better if I had started outside of museums. Like I think about all the time. One of the biggest wastes of money in our country is education, even though we should spend more money on education.
It just doesn't go to the school to prison pipeline.
It just doesn't go to the right thing.
It's not education for education's sake. Like
it is, it can be. No, that I disagree with. I think a lot of our education is education for education's sake. There's a lot of amazing people in there, but there's also pork. And so what happens is the pork, the money that is spent, and pork is just like wasted money. So like we talk about it.
I've never heard anyone use it in that way before. Is that an American thing?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, I didn't make it up. It's like a real phrase.
From Savannah, like, mm.
It's a real phrase about government spending. It's called pork. Oh. And it's just like when they're doing a bill, if you read bills, it'll be like a bill for education. And then for some reason, there's $15,000 for this representative's district for farming. And you're like, what? And that's pork.
Yeah.
But it's like, so that you'll have a lot of pork. You'll have all this like spending that's not being spent correctly, like bureaucracy and blah, blah, blah.
Then, like what most governments do.
Yeah. So that's oftentimes Department of Education funding. Like it's not something crazy has happened. Then they have to like fill that, like to pay that. And then a lot of those become like museum programs that are so half-baked. You know, and like you're like, what? You know, and some of them are great. And I think everybody is trying really hard. And that's the other thing I think that's different. The reason I would push back on what you said. Almost everybody who goes into education is trying really hard. Even honestly, the dipshits who are in it, they're actually trying. I don't think most people go in it. Like there's very few, I would say that there's very few, Betsy DeVos accepted and all of her people. But like most people are not Cruella De Vil.
I mean, some real fucking characters.
No, and I think, but if you think about like the economy of education, it's a huge economy. So like if you think
no one's a teacher because they want to make money.
Like, right. And I don't think anybody's a teacher because they're a dick. Yeah, I have to take that back. I think a lot of people are teachers because they want to be dicks. That's true. They want to be my husband always says
of power over young
that's right.
people.
My husband always says there's two kinds of people who wanted to be teachers. One, he was a teacher, so that's why he says, but and he worked with teachers. One, people who were really good at school, and two, people who wanted to be the smartest person in the room. Now, I disagree. Yep. I would say there's three people who want to communicate and help people, which is the one I am. But he's like, just think about the people you know who is teachers. Which one are they?
I've had some bizarre experiences because I have always been the student who has like been a point of tension. Because if you're a shit teacher and if you're teaching for the wrong reasons, I was always that student who was like, but why do you keep saying stuff that's like the opposite of what you're teaching? Why do you keep demonstrating behavior that goes against what you're trying to teach us?
Ooh.
Men did not like me in my undergrad program. They do not like me now. Like, we had this one darkroom teacher who was like, here's the printing and like processing machine that you can use for your prints, and you can do nothing under this size. And then in the demonstration, he put in a strip of paper that was too small that could have jammed the entire machine. And I was like, I pointed it out. I was like, but isn't that what's gonna, didn't you just tell us not to do that? So this was a guy who like had a history of just making young girls cry. And I was just like, not with me, buddy. I'm going to make you cry.
That is one thing I will say about art school that I think people have no idea how freaking hard it is and how they totally try to rock you. They try to deliberately break you down.
Seriously.
Yeah, absolutely.
Seriously.
There was a guy that I used to work with.
It's mentally aggressive going into art school.
Totally.
Programs.
And that's why like people, like I'm like, you know, like, you know, these people who are like, arts is so easy. It's easy to get into, which it's not. And then it's so easy to do it. I was like, you want to spend 8 hours standing up printing photographs?
Art World is a fucking shark tank. in every way, shape, and form.
Oh, absolutely. But like physically, like I have to say, like when I was, you know, doing, when I like take a printmaking class, this was in high school that I did a lot of printmaking, to stand and like chunk, chunk.
Oh, chunk. You guys, my body is breaking down at 30. Like, this is not easy work. Like, it's not.
Yeah, Joe has arthritis of the knees, man. Yes. He's like, it's like crazy.
I have. I don't think any. I like can't bend my right finger, like index finger, sometimes. So
I have carpal tunnel, and I used mm-hmm. to do a lot of printmaking, like cutting, like embroidery, anything that's like small handwork
with like lots of pressure.
I can't do anything anymore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I cannot. Like, I every once in a while will print something, and I can't do it.
Yep.
Like, I no longer can do that stuff.
I'm very lucky that a lot of my stuff doesn't require like super fine dexterous work. It's like, I feel very, very lucky, but like knitting really can deteriorate my hands if I'm not careful.
I can no longer knit.
And, like, my neck.
I taught the girls wanted to learn and I taught them, and then that was like the loss. And I hadn't knit in years because my hands, it got to the point where I'd be producing things like for events. So I don't make art, but I have taught it, and I don't make art as an expression, but I've taught it, and I've taught a million different classes. And a lot of the things I enjoy doing require using X-Actos or scissors to cut like really like intricate things. And so it would get so bad that I would sleep with ice on my wrists over my head. Before events, because it was so painful.
I think that this is where some of us, you know, like how John Dugdale was like a process photographer who then, when he lost his vision, kind of had to become a director and kind of give parts of his process away to other people so that he could make the art that he wanted to make. I think that that's one of the things that we should all be open to more, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I would like, love to I do everything by myself, and all I want is to like A, have enough money to pay for an assistant, and B, have like the ability to have someone I can work with and trust who I can give parts of my process over to, so that my body isn't breaking down.
Yeah, like, it is so physical. So how did you get into process photography?
So I was in my undergrad program and I was doing darkroom work, and I just kind of felt wholly unsatisfied, you know? I knew that there was more. It's actually kind of like a funny little backwards story. I decided that I wanted to do like commercial digital work. And I went to a graphic designer in Australia, in Melbourne. And she had, from Lumiere Tintype in Texas, a portrait with her and her family on her desk. And I had this like intense tunnel vision when I held it. You know, like I can't describe it other than like the entire world faded away. There was like only the object that I was holding. And there was just something kind of, you know, like how you get that pull from behind your guts. There was just something in me that was like, go figure out whatever the fuck this is. So I found Ellie Young in Trentham East in Victoria. She's like the teacher of alternative process in the Southern Hemisphere. She kind of gets flown out to China and Indonesia a lot to share her expertise. I did a one-to-one class with her because I know that I work better in a one-to-one capacity. Pixie, I heard that. And she was like, okay, you want to learn tintypes? Cool. Like, I loved vintage and antique shit. I was like an antique clothing collector. I was working very much in the realm of, you know, hanging out with people who were like antique collectors and restorers, I guess. So then I did this one day one-to-one workshop, and I like, first Ellie gets you to use baby oil across the tins. And then she stood there. She's like this tiny, tiny woman, so little. She's maybe like 5'2". And she was, yeah, but like, you actually, I think she's smaller than you.
I am 5'3".
You're a tall woman.
I'm giant.
But she kind of watched me, and she was like, I've never seen anyone pick up the physicality of this process before, like this quickly. Let's just go straight to the dark room. So without even really having to practice, like, the physical, she was just like, straight to chemistry, let's go. And then she just kind of, she maybe walked me through it twice, and then she went, go and do it yourself. Like, you've got this. Go and do it yourself. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
It was, and it was.
I feel like the process picks the person. I've heard this kind of story.
I fucking agree with you. I fucking agree with you.
So often. Like, I think about this.
There is no reason I should have been so good at that so quickly.
Yeah. I just think, like, when you, and you, like, you know, like, somebody's a printmaker, a ceramicist, whatever, enamelist.
Mm-hmm.
But then they, like, tell you about how they started doing that, and you're like, oh, it picked you. Like, I will say that I drew, and I think that's probably, like, so cutting with scissors is actually just drawing. You're just cutting, like, you're doing the same line. But, like, I honestly, like, could cut anything. Like, you could say to me, like, reindeer. I mean, people have done it. Like, my kids used to do it when they were little. Reindeer.
It's like, I used to work for a woman who was an antique clothing and homewares trader, and she has this story from when she was, like, 5 years old. There was a woman who came with a yarn spinning machine, whatever the fuck they're called. And she was like 5 years old, picked
spindle?
Up. Yeah, I think so. But the spindle's like the handheld one that you, not like the machine that you do with your foot, you know? Fuck, I should know this. This is like part of stuff that I do. But anyway, she was like 5 years old, sat down with a piece of wool and just immediately started spinning yarn. Like, and she had no reason to know how to do that as a child. And I think that I do agree process, like, really kind of does pick the person. And, like, when you hear about, like, my history, you kind of understand, right? Like, I was a weird kid that collected hair. I begged my parents to play the harp because I said it was the music of love. I was, like, on – I know. Like, we can laugh now, Savita, because, like, now it's like,
A spinning mule.
Oh. See? I knew it wasn't spindle. But also – like, how 10-year-old me was, like, referencing Sappho? I don't know.
I think people are always themselves.
I agree.
Like, in utero, I think people are themselves. So, Sophie, do you think you have to make art every day to be an artist?
Absolutely not.
And do you think to be an artist, does it have to be your job?
No.
What do you mean? Tell us.
Just, like, the whole purpose of this podcast. So, no, you don't have to make art every day. I think that if you are thinking about your practice or, like, contributing something to your practice every day, that's, like, a really nice goal to have. But it's also not realistic. Fuck's sakes, this city is driving me crazy today. It's not realistic because, like, me personally, my creativity comes in these huge 6-month bursts.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, you know, I'm really, realistically, I probably belong in the film industry because that's, like, how the film industry functions, where you do this, like, extended period and then you have, like, a 3-month holiday where you're like, oh my God, I'm cashed up. I'm going to go live my best life. Like, that's kind of how I like to work. You know, like, I'll have these seasons of creativity and then I'll have seasons of rest because rest is also productive. So
Yeah. I think that's, it is, I agree with you. Sort of. I think it's the beginning of
Great.
That sounds like I don't agree with you, but I do. I think actually, I think that I'd preface what you just said with, or maybe, like, reframe what you said, that you know who you are.
Yeah.
So how you become an artist is who, it's based on who you are. So, like, for me, I would say that my creativity is text, writing, and, you know, like, when I write, if I stop, I will stop forever. I'm like, like, switch.
Yeah.
And so I think
this in
that
the Patreon bonus.
Month. And I think that, like, what you actually want to do is think about what's the right thing for you. So if for
and
you
that might
it is
change
literally
over time.
Well, that's true too. So, like, be a human. Yeah. Artists are in fact humans. Like, you know. Some it's harder to tell, but like, you know, like, if you are a person who knows that you need to run every day, then you probably need to draw every day. If you're a person, like, start and stop, then start and stop, like, be yourself.
And, like, it also, you know, it's taken me a decade to know how my creativity works.
That's
it's
right.
taken me two
that's
very
right.
rigorous art programs to figure out how I work. It's like, it hasn't been. And, like, you know, my journey into doing what I do has taken, it took up all of my 20s. Like, guys, I've never done the Euro trip. I've never, like, been on some kind of
major
holiday for
myself. No, I think people don't realize. No.
Like, I have committed everything to the work that I make because it has been not only my own curated safe space for kind of navigating things that I've needed to process. Like, I've said this before and I'll say it again. Those photographs of me, like, kissing women from 2015 are all made before I came out. Like, I directed,
you've had a lot of growth.
Produced.
You've had a lot of growth.
I thought you said you've had a lot of girls at first. And I was like, you hear what you want to hear, you know? But, you know, it was this thing that was, it was like a compulsion for me, right?
Yeah.
Because I was figuring out who I was through making this work. And it became more of that, and it's still that. And now I'm kind of doing this thing where I can, like, bring people in to kind of explore their own creativity through working together, which I think is one of the coolest parts of kind of how I've shifted my practice now. So just, like, find what works for you and what you enjoy doing, and, like, what, like, even if it exhausts you, if you walk away feeling, like, emotionally filled or fueled in some way, like, I think that's part of the art. My sessions exhaust me, but I love what happens in that space.
I agree. Okay, so if that's our origin story,
yeah, the villain.
What's our villain origin story, i.e. our journey onto TikTok?
I needed money. I needed, well, also because, like, I left grad school.
You're not in the creative fund because you're in the Australian TikTok. You wanted to publicize your art.
Well, because also, like, you get the boot out of grad school. They go, fuck off and see you later. We've gotten all of your money. So good luck. And if you are successful enough, we will retroactively claim you and be like, oh, look what we did. We built this artist. When in reality, like, it's all what people do on their own. So, like, I got the boot out of my program. I was desperate for community and to, like, be talking to people who were interested in what I was interested in, because I went from having this, like, kind of close-knit family type thing through the pandemic, because we were all, like, pandemic people as well. We did all of our grad school I did it overnight online in Australia. It was horrible. And then I was kind of just, like, adrift and completely unmoored in, you know, the art world here, going, what the fuck do I do next? Like, I don't have a job. I'm on, like, the weird year of placement after my student visa. Like, where do I go next? So I kind of just started jumping on the internet, talking about the stuff that I was passionate about. My first big video that blew up was the one where you found me, Vimea, and talking about, like, masters in art and how it's all kind of a weird facade. And then I guess it kind of just, like, my villain origin story is also just, like, the ethics of portraiture and, like, how men operate in these industries and why I want to just, like, castrate all of what? Nothing. I'm just going to cut myself off. What's your villain origin story, Seema?
I have worked in digital content in museums for many years, and I did TikTok for a museum, and I left that job and I decided I could do better communication outside of museums. And so I kind of wanted to just, you know, show.
Say the things you couldn't say before.
Yeah, exactly. Show the establishment what would actually work. And so then I did that. And then very quickly, I found that I enjoy
the subtext here is she people. You were giving your old job the middle finger, right?
Indeed. Yeah. And and I realized I enjoyed and got a lot of views for arguing with dumb people on the internet. And so I have to admit, I still kind of really enjoy
it. Villain origin story becomes daily pastime.
And what the thing that's so funny about the trolls is, they really think we're upset. When we're like, I'm just using you for views, man.
I know.
I'm just earning money. Like, you just keep doing it, like, dummy.
Okay, like, sidebar. Did you see that Risa Tisa made, like, $85,000 or $89,000 off of her
series? No, but I saw that too, but then did you hear her say it?
No.
Okay. I didn't.
I saw that as, like, secondhand information.
No, somebody estimated it. She got kicked out of the Creators Fund.
Probably because she was making too much.
No, well, I mean, yeah. But because she wasn't in the Creators Fund until, like, halfway through. It's, like, some point in the series. And then She reposted.
She's doing fine.
No, I know. I don't know how much she made. I can't remember how much she actually made, but she didn't make nearly as much as people were estimating, she said, because she got kicked out of the Creators Fund, and then people followed her. And, you know, you don't get paid if your followers see you on the follow page.
Yeah.
So some of those estimates are way high. And then she reposted. And, you know, they don't let you repost and make money again. Mm. And so, like, she got screwed. So I don't think she made as much as everyone said. I don't know how much she made, but not that much. But so, yes, I enjoyed arguing with people. And here I am.
I guess, do we want to talk about, like, our intentions for our platforms?
Well, I don't know. What are our intentions? I do think one thing I'm going to put in the show notes is I'm excited to get back into our Discord. I was thinking in our Discord, we should be like, Art Loss Podcast, have like a podcast channel and talk about the podcast and what topics you want.
Yeah. And that can also just double up as Patreon content, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's, I don't know. I mean, I definitely think for us having more communication, having more communication channels will be great. Becoming more and more professional on this channel, more ads and, you know, things that like kind of encourage people to watch it.
Yeah.
What else are you hoping for us?
So my hopes for this production, I really, really, I want it to be the resource that, like, I always needed kind of coming out of my art programs, which was, like, someone I kind of felt like I could check in with to, like, stay in the loop with kind of what's going on in the industry, people I could ask questions to, and just, like, generally a larger and, like, not feeling siloed, I think, is one of the most important parts for me about what we're doing here is kind of, like, not allowing these weird little kind of pockets where this stuff is allowed to exist to kind of be the status quo anymore. I think for me, like, you've kind of said it before, right? Like, I'm a bit of a dreamer, and I very much am interested in creating new ways for artists to kind of operate and move through space together, because, like, what we have now just isn't enough for where the world is going. And I would say, well,
that's a great origin story. That's like a great, like, that's who we are. That's great.
Yes. Like, I think that's one of the reasons, like, why when we found each other, we were kind of like, you understand the way I think and I understand the way you think. And we have this, like, we have a shared understanding of kind of coming from those spaces and what it means to be existing in these kinds of everyday spaces and what it means to have people who are willing to kind of break that mold and kind of bring, you know, that stuff that is so fucking inaccessible all the time. Because I think that's one of the things we bonded over really early on, was just like the total lack of access that kind of exists out there in the world. So that's like my hopes and dreams for this. And then
hopes and dreams.
And then my personal hopes and dreams is like, I just want to be known for the work that I do, because I think I have some of the best work in my industry, and I'm tired of not getting the views that I deserve. So, or the income.
Well, that's a good place to end. Where can we view your stuff?
You can find me on TikTok at Darkroom Varmint, VARMINT, or one word. And you can find me on Instagram at Sophie Chalk Studio. You can also find my website, sophiechalk.com. I also have a print shop, sophiechalkstudio.com. I'm going to be, like, reconciling some stuff this year, probably. I don't know. But, like, you can find me all over. You can find me by my alias, my online alias, or you can find me by my real name.
You can find me, artlust_, on YouTube.
Yes. You can find us. We're figuring out our TikTok page so that we can actually be on the Creator Fund. It's all going to happen. We're going to have an Instagram. Our Discord details will be up and running. You guys, by mid-year, we're going to have everything figured out.
Agreed.
I mean, like, it's going to take some time. But, like, we're gonna get our visual companions. We're going to get, like, maybe our website up and running again.
Yes.
I'm going to nag you about this. We are going to improve our video content because, like, sorry, but being in a Zoom call vibe is not the vibe. So, actually, if you could download your live stream today and send it to me, that'd be really great. Please and thank you. Yes?
Thank you for listening. Did we finish? Sorry, these people are very
appeared. Did finish. Seema, yes. That part was for you. You got to download your live stream and
send it. Oh, yeah, I was listening.
Did you? Yeah. I know.
I didn't listen. I didn't hear what you said.
Okay, great job, gang.